Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for October's Nurses Club webinar. I'm delighted to introduce you to our speaker for today, Clinical Support Manager at VetsNow, Louise O'Dwyer. Thank you, Louise. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much, Aima, and good afternoon, everybody. It's a beautiful October, although I am feeling a little bit sad because I came back from Ireland yesterday. So we were just chatting about how you don't appreciate how beautiful everywhere it is that you live until you kind of take somebody else. So I had a friend over from the States, so I showed her around Ireland and how pretty it is. So I'm a little bit fed up today, but we'll cheer myself up by talking about one of my favorite things, which is looking at inpatients and how we can monitor them and of how we can do a lot better for our patients in our practice, and just maybe thinking about what we're doing and why we're actually doing what we're doing. So inpatient monitoring for me is one of the most important things that we do with our patients. You know, I've always worked in clinics where nurses are very much responsible for looking at the patients that they have in, being part of that initial assessment, looking at how those patients respond to therapy and respond to treatment. And so, yes, as nurses, I always say this, we can't diagnose, we can't prescribe, but we're in part, you know, hugely important part of looking at these patients and feeding back to our vets as to how our patients are responding to the treatments they've prescribed, and alerting them if things go wrong and letting them know if patients are looking at a lot better. And inpatient monitoring is not just about looking at patients that are in for, you know, maybe medical procedures or treatment. Patient monitoring is looking at those patients during the recovery period as well, because we know the recovery period for our patients is a period at which they're, you know, at high risk of things going wrong. You know, around 50% of all our patients die during that recovery period if they're going to have things that are going to go wrong. So close attention to detail during this period is hugely, hugely important. So when we're looking at monitoring these critical patients, as I said, we're looking at predicting serious changes in that patient's condition and hopefully avoiding them, flagging up if we've got any concerns during that period. It's about monitoring a patient that provides a means of re-evaluating that patient's condition and response to therapy. So that's particularly important, whether that therapy be medications we're giving them, remembering that fluid therapy is a medication. If you've got a patient that's, you know, shocked and we're giving them fluids and we're giving them rapid boluses of intravenous fluids, we're looking to see if those patients' parameters, their heart rate, their, you know, their pulse quality, their mucous membrane color, all those things come back to the place where we want them to be. And whilst individual values are really important, you know, we're looking at really monitoring trends in these patients, looking at if things are improving, as we said, in moving in the direction that we're expecting those trends to move in. And so whilst we have lots and lots of really useful monitoring equipment, and we'll talk about some of those things, not in a lot of detail, but, you know, we have pulse oximeters, we've got ECGs, we've got blood pressure machines. What we need to remember, what's really, really important, is us listening to our patients. It's having hands-on techniques. It's about looking at our patients, you know, auscultation, you know, combining all those things that we're going to talk about within this lecture. And what also is really, really important is us thinking about what's going on, treating that patient as a whole, and thinking about what we expect to happen when we treat these patients with the treatment that we're giving to them. So again, as nurses, this is where education comes in. This is where learning comes in. We should know how we're expecting those patients to respond to what we're giving to them. Having a conversation with the vets, if this is not something we're familiar with before, to say, what should I be looking for with this patient? And then you know whether what we're doing is working or not. And if it's not working, going back to those vets and saying, what you said was likely to happen isn't happening, or what we know to expect to happen isn't happening. Or if it is, do we want to stop what we're doing and then look at maybe adapting that a little bit, or maybe doing something else altogether? So this is where we want to, you know, think outside the box and think about doing more than just what we're used to doing. We want to know how to expect those drugs to work in those patients and how we expect those patients to respond to them. And part of that is looking at how we're going to record what's happening with these patients. And recording is more just writing down all these values. When we're looking at recording, it's about knowing who and how we're going to contact. So that be making sure we've got owner's details. A lot of the time I'll go back to owners and I'll maybe speak to them and say, you know, what's this animal like normally? What's that animal's mentation like normally? I always talk about my dogs during my lectures, but, you know, if people didn't speak to me about what my dogs behave like normally, they could think my lazy, lazy mastiff is really dull and really depressed. Now, he isn't really dull and depressed. He's just like that normally. Last night, I came home from a week away. He was not bothered about me at all. He was sulking big time, yeah? I know that's normal for him. He only responded in a normal way when he thought he was likely to get some human food, which he wasn't going to get, but he still thinks he's got a good chance of that happening. We also want to know which vets are in charge of that case as well, so as well as having owner's details, which vets are in charge of that case too. We want to make sure we've got a full problem list, and we'll look at that on the next page. For some of our patients, we may want to look at resuscitation status, and, you know, that's not going to be for every patient coming in for maybe routine procedures. I do realize that things can go wrong even with routine things. But, you know, if patients are coming in, we know they've got end-stage organ failure, you know, they're treated for a certain disease, do we actually want to resuscitate that patient? We want to look at that from an ethical point of view. We'll want to look at it, you know, is it fair to that patient to do that? We want to maybe have that conversation with those owners beforehand. And we also, and we'll look at this again on another slide, want to know when to contact the vet. So we have alert parameters on our hospital sheets. So it pulls up actually when we're going to go and alert a vet as to whether this patient's blood glucose is very low or whether that patient's lactate is high. So again, it means that we don't have to keep going backwards and forwards to the vets. We know when we want to be concerned about something going on with our patients when we're monitoring them. As I said, we want to think about everything as a whole. So we want to have a complete problem list for all of those critical patients. So, for example, you can see this patient's had a septic bile peritonitis. It's had a cholecystectomy. Other problems this patient's got is neutrophilia, vomiting, diarrhea, hypoxia. This patient's also got dilated cardiomyopathy. It's got an elevated thromboplastin time. There's other details on there about where it's got catheters, its blood type. We maybe don't have all those details for every single patient, but it's worth thinking about everything that's going on. We could also maybe add on relevant information about drugs and medications that patient is maybe on there, because some of the drugs or medications can affect what anaesthetic agents we want to use, what other drugs we want to use, maybe what drugs we maybe don't want to mix in that patient. So it's a thinking about everything that could have an impact on that animal. As I said, we also have alert parameters on there. They're individual parameters that for that individual patient, that means, you know, as we can see in this animal, if this animal's PCV drops below 25, we need to go and tell the vet. If their total solids drop below 35, we go and tell the vet. If their potassium gets low, we go and tell them. If their pulse rate, as you can see over on the right-hand side, is above 150, we will go and tell the vet. And it just means, particularly I find this useful for maybe less experienced staff. So if we don't know at what point we need to go and alert someone, we've got that locked down. You know, we all are busy. We're busy for different reasons, be it because we have lots of routine procedures or because we have lots of, you know, very sick inpatients. So this for me just gives us that little bit of reassurance that we know when to become concerned and know when to go and get those vets and pull them away from what they're doing, which again, if we have any concerns, we should always be happy to do that. So we're going to start by looking at the respiratory system in these patients. And so whether I'm triaging a patient or whatever I'm doing, I generally will start kind of with the respiratory system first. For me, in my mind, if something fails with the respiratory system, that's likely to have an impact on that patient more quickly than if it's the cardiovascular system. So whenever I look at the respiratory systems in patients, I look at its assessment as being divided up between auscultation, so listening to that patient, observation, looking at how they're breathing, and some palpation as well. So as nurses, I think we don't generally get taught how to listen to patients' chests, and we should be being taught how to do this. If you don't know, get your vets to spend 5 minutes with you going through how they will listen to a patient's chest. The way I approach it is I will divide that patient's chest up like a noughts and crosses board and compare it. I compare left with right, dorsally with ventrally. I'm trying to pick up, have we got any muffled sounds? If they are muffled, are they muffled dorsally or are they muffled ventrally? Have we got increased sounds? So we've got some increased sounds on the next couple of the slides as examples. So those increased sounds could be stertor or stridor. So stertor or lower pitched airway sounds. So the type you get with brachycephalic. So I've got a mastiff. He will get some stertor when he's been for a walk. He has this that noisy upper airway breathing, the lower pitch sounds. Stridor are higher pitch sounds associated with that upper airway. We can get wheezes, we can get crackles, and I've got some examples of wheezes and crackles on the next couple of slides, some little audio clips. Again, if you've got patients on big volumes of fluids, listening for things like crackles, that could be a sign that the patient's got fluid overload, so it's developing pulmonary edema, really, really important. We want to know what normal lung sounds are, so that's listening to all your healthy patients as well as those unhealthy patients. And what we're going to do is we're going to use that auscultation and we're going to use that to localize the region that's affected on that patient. So we're going to do that listening with that stethoscope in combination with looking at what's going on with that patient. So as we can see here, we're localizing that affected region, which is going to be auscultation and observation to figure out if it's a upper airway, upper respiratory tract issue, or a lower small airway disease. So is it feline asthma or is it laryngeal paralysis? And we're going to see big differences and we're going to hear big differences depending on which point a part of that upper patient's airway is affected. And we'll, again, come to that in a couple of slides' time. So hopefully this should work for you. So this is a little audio clip of wheezes, which are noises that we get where we've got lower airways being affected. So what we've got is turbulence through narrowed passageway. So this is things like feline asthma, where we literally get squeakiness or wheezes. So hopefully if I play this, you can hear that squeakiness, that wheeziness. It's not always as consistent as that. You know, if you do, again, if you're not used to hearing these noises, go back to your vets and say, the next time you get a cat in that's wheezy, can you come and let me in? It's more common in cats. We tend to see, you know, cats with asthma relatively frequently. So what we can hear is those, it's a little bit like if you're in an alleyway and you hear the wind whistling through it, but in a different way. Other sounds that we can hear can be crackles. So crackles are basically where we have alveoli that have got fluid in them. So these are alveoli blind ending thin wall sacs that are collapsing down and kind of sticking shut a little bit because there's fluid in there. So as I said, if you've got pulmonary edema, we can hear this. If we've got pneumonia, sometimes we can hear this. If patients have got fluid overload, we can sometimes pick this up. And they sound like wet alveoli kind of snapping shut and popping back open. So you're probably familiar with your own chest sounding like this. If you've had a really bad case, a really horrible cold or the flu, you can feel that rattle in your chest, and that's what we're hearing with crackles. So again, you need to listen to lots of normal patients to pick that up as an abnormality on your sicker patients. We're also going to do some observation, and I've got a couple of slides and I'm going to go quite quickly because I've put quite a lot of videos in this. We're going to look at posture, we're going to look at rate, we're going to look at pattern. Is that posture appropriate for that patient? Patients should feel quite relaxed. They should feel like they can lie down and go to sleep. Patients that have got respiratory issues can't relax because if they start to relax, they can't breathe properly. So we're looking, is that patient's respiratory rate appropriate? And again, considering it within the context of that patient's environment, you know, is that patient tachypneic because it's stressful? Is it because it's painful? Has it got abdominal enlargement so they can't take a normal breath? Is its pattern normal? It should normally be an inspiratory to expiratory ratio of about 1:2:3. Yeah. Patients that have got upper airway issues will have prolonged inspiratory time because it's taking longer for them to get that breath in. If you think about brachycephalics, they've got a narrowed upper airway for lots of reasons, but one because they've got small nostrils. So if you occlude 2/3 of your nostrils and try and breathe in, you'll see that it takes you much longer to get that breath in. Look at the amount of effort. Even if I play this video without the audio, you can see this cat has got more effort. It's got abdominal movement because it's becoming exhausted. Its respiratory muscles are not working as they should do. It started to get paradoxical movement, so its abdomen sucking in when that patient takes a breath in. We also want to look is the symmetry. So I'll play this video quickly. Yes, we can hear that patient's got upper airway noise, yeah? We can hear that's not normal, but when you look at that cat, even with our audio, you should be able to see that that cat is not breathing normally. We also have other changes. So again, different things will happen for different reasons. Dogs often develop what we call orthopneic posture. So this is where they extend their necks, open their mouths to make it easier to get air in. So that's always a classic sign of something going wrong. If you look at this patient's got laryngeal paralysis. So he's got a prolonged inspiratory time. He really, when you watch him, he goes... And then he's got forced expiration, which is very short. So he's got the opposite of what normally happens. We normally have a shorter expiration, then a pause, and then expiration. This dog takes a long time to get a breath in, and then you see him drop down when he takes that breath out. I'll play this quickly, then talk through the rest of that slide.
No,
and he's got that classic outstretched neck. He's trying to straighten out his upper airway as much as he can to make it easier to get that breath in. We also look at that animals from how they're behaving. So again, if patients start to shift position, particularly cats, if they're in sternal recumbency, I'll start to think, is there something going on? Is this animal really beginning to struggle? Animals that lay down on their side and are notably dyspneic is a really bad sign, and particularly in cats. Those animals, now we tend to be much more likely to knock out and take over their airway, take over work of breathing for them, give them a make life a little bit easier. As we said at the beginning, it's also a combination of palpation as well. So we want to gently feel, can we feel any crepitus? Has that patient got any subcutaneous emphysema? Is there symmetry to when that patient breathes? Can we see any obvious full chest segments, or can we feel them that we're suspicious about, or can we see them on x-ray? So we look at this cat in the top right-hand slide, and we can see it on that video. This cat's got an obvious flail chest segment. If you've ever, you know, if you've ever broken a rib, it's meant to be incredibly painful. If you get a stitch, it's painful enough. So I would imagine having a few broken ribs is really sore. Analgesia is massively important in these patients to make it easier for them to breathe. So as well as look at those hands-on, looking at, listening to techniques, we also have tools that make life a little bit easier to help us detect whether patients have problem. So we've got pulse oximetry. This measures the amount of saturation of hemoglobin with oxygen. It doesn't tell us about ventilation. It doesn't tell us how well that patient's getting rid of carbon dioxide. The downside to me, and the reason why we often say pulse oximeters are quite limiting, particularly in patients under anaesthesia, is they're really quite insensitive to earlier hypoxia, particularly in patients that are breathing an enriched oxygen. So particularly patients under anaesthesia on 100% oxygen. They also have some limitations. They can be inaccurate. So if you've got poor probe positioning, if you've got movement, it can sometimes pick up movement as being a pulse. If you've got low pulse pressure, sometimes you don't get adequate perfusion to those tissues to pick up a good pulse oximeter reading. If you've got pigmented skin, so the classic one is always chows and things like that, it won't pick up. It's also limited with carbon monoxide poisoning. If you've had a patient that has been in a house fire and has carbon monoxide poisoning, your pulse oximeter will read carboxyhemoglobin, so carbon monoxide bound to hemoglobin, as being oxyhemoglobin, so oxygen bound to hemoglobin. So be aware, if you stick a pulse oximeter on a patient that's been in a house fire, even if it reads 100%, I won't believe it's 100%. You have to use other techniques of ensuring that patient is oxygenated. When I'm looking at a pulse oximeter, I'm going to make sure that patient's heart rate matches what it says it is on that pulse oximeter, so I'll physically measure that patient's pulse. I'll look at that trace form, I'll look at that pleth, and look to see if that looks nice and clean, if we have that available. And much as we know they can be misleading and they don't always tell the truth, I would say ignore abnormal values at your peril, because if these patients are deteriorating, they're going to be in big trouble very, very quickly. So I'm going to try, and then I know this is a difficult concept to sometimes get your head around, I'm going to try and explain the oxygen dissociation curve. So this is a curve that matches, as we can see on here, our pulse oximetry reading, which we've got along the left-hand side, with our PaO2. So this is the amount of oxygen that is dissolved in plasma. And we have this particular shape to this curve. It's a bit like a cliff. So everything's going along fine, and then it reaches a point at which patients desaturate very, very quickly. And it's this shape because of the way oxygen binds to hemoglobin. So what happens is the first molecule of oxygen is quite difficult to bind to hemoglobin. And then once one molecule is attached, it changes the shape of that hemoglobin and makes it much easier for the other three molecules of oxygen to bind, okay? And it works in the other way as well. So it's very difficult for the first molecule to drop off as patients desaturate. Once that one's gone, changes the shape, and the others follow it really, really quickly. So this is the point at which we're worried. So a lot of the textbooks will say, you know, a normal pulse oximetry reading should be between above anything above 95. And if we look at this, if we go along to 95, to see where it crosses that curve here, that's at 80, okay? So a normal PaO2, and this is how they correlate, a normal PaO2, amount of oxygen dissolved in plasma, is between 80 and 100. And we know this, that, you know, these are textbook values, but we can calculate what a patient's PaO2 should be using something called the 5x rule. So you take whatever that patient is inspiring. So if they're breathing in room air, they should be breathing in around 21% oxygen, times that by 5. That means a patient's PaO2 should be around 105, okay? Anything below 80, we say that patient is becoming hypoxic, and I've got that on that next slide. So 80 is the low end of normal, and that correlates to that SaO2 of 95 and 94. That's where that kind of low end of normal, that's the point at which we should start to worry if our patient's pulse oximeter settings readings drop anything below that. Anything below 60, a PaO2 of 60, that patient is severely hypoxemic. That's the point at which we should start to ventilate a patient. And that only correlates to an SpO2 of about 88. So it doesn't take much for things start to go wrong, and that's related to that shape of that curve. You know, a patient can be fine, SpO2 of 94, and then things start to go wrong, and they will desaturate very, very quickly, okay? Now, this is fine if patients are breathing room air. If they're breathing anything other than room air, so patients under anesthesia, it takes us much longer to notice as a problem. So if you imagine, we said, with that 5x rule, if they're breathing room air, their PaO2 should be about 100 if they've got normal lung function. If they're breathing 100% oxygen under anesthesia, their PaO2 should be about 500. If that patient has an issue, it's going to take us a long period of time before we see that change on that pulse oximeter. And that's why we say it's a very, very late indicator of patients becoming hypoxemic, patients having issues. That's why when we're monitoring our inpatients that are probably just breathing room air, or maybe only breathing in an oxygen-enriched environment, so not 100% oxygen, it's a useful technique because we see those changes much, much more quickly. I hope that makes sense. I do realise it's a little bit of a difficult thing to get your head around. Gold standard way of actually knowing exactly what's going on in that patient's bloodstream would be to do arterial blood gas analysis. Most of us are not going to have this available. This gives us the most information about ventilation and oxygenation because we can look at the amount of oxygen in the bloodstream. We can look at the amount of carbon dioxide in the bloodstream. We also can look at other things like acid-base assessment. Really useful. The downsides are is you need to measure oxygenation, get an arterial puncture, so get a needle into that artery to collect a sample, or place a catheter, which is much more painful and it's much more stressful for the patient. If patients have got coagulopathies, that makes it much more difficult to do as well. And you do have to have blood gas machines available in your clinics to do that. So for most of us, it's not going to be available. The other thing that we're going to look at is the cardiovascular system. So again, hands-on techniques, observation, palpation, auscultation to assess the whole of the system. And there's lots of things that we're looking at. And when we're really looking at the cardiovascular system, what we're trying to do is assess perfusion of tissues. Perfusion is massively important because we need to make sure we're getting oxygenated blood moving around the body, being delivered to those patients' tissues. If that doesn't happen, they're going to die. So we're going to start off with heart auscultation and pulse palpation, so checking that patient's heart rate. And again, looking to think, is it appropriate for that patient in that situation? Generally in dogs, their heart rate is somewhere between 80 and 120. We get a little bit of variation with breed, not an awful lot. Again, a lot of the time these patients have got heart rates that are slightly increased because they're a little bit stressed, because they're in an odd environment, and something's normally happened to them and they've been driven to the clinics. We do get a variation as well depending on patients how fit they are. So patients that tend to be fitter tend to have lower heart rates. So again, we want to consider all of that when we're assessing this in these patients and assessing their condition. In dogs, what we generally get is a fairly uniform increase in heart rate as they become hypervolemic. In dogs, as they become more hypervolemic, their heart rates tend to go up. Cats, it doesn't always work like that. Cats will become tachycardic up to a point where they realise that actually their stroke volume, the amount of blood being pumped out of their heart with each heartbeat, is not effective. And at that point, they'll start to become bradycardic. So I would say anything above 250 in cats, I start to be concerned. But anything, and I've said below 100, but actually for me, below 140, I start to be concerned that there's something going on with that cat, either severely hypervolemic or even something going on with their potassium, so a hyperkalemic patient. If I've got dogs, I again look at the breed, look at the species, you know, figure how fit and healthy that dog is. Anything above 200 is likely to mean that patient's got a dysrhythmia. Anything below 40, unless they're super fit, again, I'm likely to put an ECG on that patient to see has it got a tachyarrhythmia or bradyarrhythmia. So again, really low or really high heart rates. And again, these are things that we're likely to have to monitor in our patients. Some of us may be lucky enough to have time to do ECGs in all patients preoperatively. And if you can do that, quite often you'll pick up arrhythmias on patients that are sick. So patients particularly with abdominal disease quite often will have tachyarrhythmias because they can have things like ventricular premature contractions or ventricular tachycardia. Old patients, so our giant breeders, often will have atrial arrhythmias. So again, they can have low heart rates. We want to do some auscultation. How can we pick up a murmur in our patients? Have we got muffled heart sounds? If they're muffled, is it because they're severely hypervolemic, so they've not got the blood volume coming back to the heart? The hearts aren't pumping normal volumes of blood out. Is it because we've got a pleural effusion? So something sitting in that pleural space that's stopping those heart sounds, and they'll stop lung sounds as well, getting through to Bellevue stethoscope. Whenever I'm palpating a patient's pulse, whenever I listen to a patient's heart, I will always also palpate a pulse at the same time to make sure the two correlate with each other as well. So as well as checking that heart rate, we're going to look at other perfusion parameters. We're going to look at that patient's circulation, and we're going to do an assessment of that patient's systemic perfusion. And again, that's a combination of observation, palpation, and auscultation. So we're going to look at mucous membrane colour, capillary refill time, again, checking those pulses and feeling what the quality is like. And putting that information together along with our heart rate, our pulse rate, and that auscultation that we've done in that patient. So we can look at these patients' mucous membranes. Hopefully, you look at that patient in the top right photo and think, that dog looks a little bit on the pale side. That dog in that bottom left photo, hopefully you all think that's not a good colour. That's a very jaundiced, that's a very yellow patient. And that cat in the bottom right, that patient needs some oxygen. So we're looking at that mucous membrane colour. Is it appropriate? Is it bright red because it's a septic patient, so it's completely vasodilated and it's got a really fast capillary refill time? Or is that patient really pale like in that top right photo? If that patient, you imagine doing a blanching his mucous membranes, looking at a capillary refill time, we can imagine that being really slow or completely non-existent because he's hypervolemic, he's not got normal circulating blood volume, so he's not perfusing his tissues as you'd expect him to. As we said, we're also going to palpate these patients' pulses. I'll do this at the same time as listening to that patient's heartbeat. As well as palpating a central pulse, like a femoral pulse, I'll also palpate a distal pulse as well. Generally, if we haven't got a distal pulse in that patient, it suggests they are at least moderately hypervolemic, but we do get some variation between patients. My dog, as I know, one of my dogs has got not great peripheral pulses in one of his back legs, and that's just normal for him. So again, we interpret it along with all those other clinical signs that we've just been talking about, all those other perfusion parameters. And what we're going to do, particularly when we feel a central pulse like a femoral pulse, is we're getting an idea of that patient. We're feeling that patient's pulse profile. We're feeling their pulse quality, and that gives us an idea of that patient's stroke volume. Stroke volume being how much blood is ejected from the heart with each heartbeat. And what we should feel in a normal, healthy patient is that normal pulse that we can see along that left-hand side. We should feel a nice, strong pulse. We should feel it across several fingers, and what we're feeling in effect is a wave of blood being ejected out of the heartbeat, travelling along that circulatory system and reaching that femoral artery. So we're feeling that pulse, and they are going to get shallower and shallower and shallower as they move away from that patient's heart. So it should be nice and strong in that big central pulse, like the femoral pulse, and get and feel much more different in that peripheral pulse. So what we're going to do is assess these patients' pulses, and again, this is going to be one of the things that we look to see if a patient's responding to treatment. If patients are hypovolemic, as you can see in these images here, those pulses will generally get shallower. So you can imagine if you could feel this pulse probably over about 3 or 4 fingers. In this patient, it's only going to be up across about 1, 1.5, 2 fingers. With this one, maybe with this, only across half a finger. So it's weaker and weaker and weaker. And it will feel weaker and weaker as it becomes shallower and shallower. Initially, as patients become hypovolemic, they'll get a sharp, snappy, what we call bounding pulse, as that patient tries to maintain perfusion around the body. But as they become more hypovolemic, that gets more difficult to do. And we feel those changes with that patient's pulse quality under our fingers. Now, most of us are probably not going to do this, but another thing that we could do to assess that patient's circulating volume is to do central venous pressure monitoring. Probably only a handful of you will be doing this. Central venous pressure is used to estimate the filling pressures in the right side of the heart. So it looks at the amount of blood returning back to the heart. This is a useful technique. We're not going to do it in every patient, but it's good in patients that have got cardiac disease, patients with renal disease, where we're worried about fluid overload in them. We do this in septic patients as well, where we're giving them lots of fluid and need to make sure we don't overdo things. With this technique, we need to have the placement of a central line, so normally a jugular catheter, and that's also useful because it allows us to sample these patients, take blood samples regularly, and we can give fluids and medications through that central line as well. So central venous pressure is actually a much better measure of intravascular volume than arterial blood pressure. Arterial blood pressure is a really, really useful technique, but it doesn't kind of give us everything. Yeah, it will tell us that pressure. Those patients, if they're very vasoconstricted, can have a normal blood pressure, which is why we don't just use one parameter to assess perfusion in these patients. It's a very useful thing to do. We would want a patient to have a systolic blood pressure of 90 or a mean arterial pressure of 60, but again, we're looking in that in combination with everything else. Central venous pressure tells us about intravascular volume as a whole. So it's really useful in optimizing fluid therapy in patients where volume overload is a big concern. So as we said, particularly cardiac disease, also patients that have got severe hyperproteinemia. We can also use it as part of diagnosis, things like patients that have got right-sided heart disease as well. The other organ system that we're going to look at is our patient's central nervous system, and I touched on this again when I said about talking to owners about what that patient is like normally. So we're going to assess these patients. Have they got abnormal mentation? Again, remembering the spinal cord is that central nervous system, so have they got normal gait as well? Is what we think is going on with that patient in keeping with all our other findings? If not, is there something going on that central nervous system? And what I mean by that is, your brain demands about 20% of all your cardiac output. 20% of everything that's ejected from your heart will go to the brain. And that's taking with it oxygen and glucose. So your brain needs a constant supply of oxygen and glucose to work normally. If we don't get that, if we get a lack of perfusion, that's going to affect kind of mentation in our patient. Reduced perfusion means we're not getting glucose, we're not getting oxygen to the brain. And we see changes in mentation. You have seen all, I'm sure, those really aggressive dogs that come in, they've maybe had vomiting and diarrhea for a period of time, they haven't got normal perfusion, and so that reduced perfusion means that we see that change in that patient's mentation because we're not getting normal blood flow to the brain. We give them some fluids, they get perfusion back again, and they become, you know, much more difficult to treat. When we're looking at patients' mentation and we're classifying it, we should classify them as being alert and normally responsive. Below that, patients are obtunded. So patients that are obtunded, ones that we would normally say, oh, they're quite depressed, they're mentally dull, but obtunded is a much better, more professional way of putting it. Below that, patients become stuporous. Stuporous patients are those that are arousable only by painful stimuli. Okay, so this is patients, and we'll see a video next of a patient that is stuporous. He is non-responsive to his environment, is non-responsive to auditory stimuli, to having his name shouted or hand clapping. And so what we did with that patient is we gave him a nip with some artery forceps to see if he was responsive to painful stimuli. If he wasn't, we would then classify him as being comatose. When we're looking at assessing mentation, as we said, we want to think about things that can change patients' mentation, so non-neurological effects. So hypoglycemia can make a difference. I'm sure you've all seen puppies that are hypoglycemic and they can be seizuring because they've not got that glucose delivered to their brain. We want to think about drugs that patients had. If they've had some opioids, that can make a difference, and perfusion as well. So we're looking at that patient and thinking, what's going on with them, and is the degree of mental depression we're seeing in that patient appropriate for what we think that patient's issue is? So this is a video of us doing a small animal coma score on a patient, and this shows the effect a lack of perfusion to the brain can have. So this is a dog that managed to strangle himself by getting his tag caught in his cage for a period of time. So therefore, he didn't have normal oxygen delivery to his brain, and this was the changes that we saw. So this is a dog called Freddy, which you'll figure out in a second. And this is assessing his mentation. Freddy. And you can see this dog is non-responsive. This is a stuporous dog. Doesn't Freddy. Respond to anything. And with Freddy, what we'll see on the next slide is we also see changes to his motor activity because of that reduced blood flow to his brain. So we've got another video where we're assessing motor activity. We're looking at his proprioception. We're looking to see if he does anything abnormal and weird, which he does. If you watch his legs, what he does with his legs, you can see that's not normal in this patient as well, because he's like falling all over the place. You'll see particularly when the nurse tries to lift up his right fore, he does something weird. He picks up his left hind. And that's because a lot of his central nervous system has been affected by having that decreased blood flow to his brain. We'll come back to Freddy a little bit later on. Urine output is another thing that we want to monitor in these patients. It's one of the most important indicators of renal function and blood pressure in our critically ill patients. It's also important in patients that we are concerned have got kidney issues as well. And also we want to keep an eye on it in patients that have got abdominal trauma, pelvic trauma, that have got neurological problems. So we want to make sure these patients are producing adequate amounts of urine. So normal urine output should be anything between, well, ideally 1 to 2 mils per kilo per hour, but anything above 0.5 mil per kilo per hour. So again, sometimes for us it's difficult to actually measure that in clinical practice. We don't want to go placing indwelling urinary catheters into all patients, because that can cause bacterial infection, it can cause urethral trauma. But we can measure the volume of urine these patients are producing, either when they're going outside to urinate if they're able to do that, or we can weigh bedding going in or bedding coming out when they urinate. We can measure those patients before they go out for a wee, and when they come back in for a wee, we can measure the volume of cats are urinated into their litter trays. Another useful thing to do as well as part of monitoring these patients is to do a specific gravity every time we're able to collect some urine from that patient to see if they're appropriately concentrating the urine for what we think is going on with their renal function, for how hydrated we think that patient is. Keeping an eye on the GI system, again, is an all-important part of monitoring. So, you know, logging when these patients are vomiting, have they got diarrhea, keeping an eye on them for being constipated as well, because they're going to get really uncomfortable associated with that. Are we concerned that patient's got ileus? Have they not got normal GI movement? Do we want to look at addressing medications to do with that? You know, if patients are on opioids for a long period of time, you know, they can start to get constipated quite easily. You know, the other thing is if they're producing large volumes of diarrhea, we need to look at how much fluid we're giving to these patients. We can bolus in a litre of fluids to a patient. If they have horrendous diarrhea, that's our litre of fluid there on the floor. So thinking about that patient as a whole. Well, I've got a little photo of his here. These are really useful. These are fecal management systems. So these are like a bit like Foley catheters that go up patients' bums if they've got horrendous liquid diarrhea. And what you have is like an inflatable, the only way you can describe it, it's like a donut at the end. So you sit it inside the rectum and inflate this kind of bulb at the end that stops that patient being able to push it out. And then that means if they've got really bad diarrhea, and particularly useful in big, big patients, that diarrhea passes down that tube and then gets collected in that bag that you can see here. Now, they are reasonably expensive systems. You can buy more of these collection bags, and actually you can cold sterilize this. If you think about it, we reuse Higginson syringes all the time. But those big, you know, 40 kilo plus patients, if they've got horrendous diarrhea that they're producing all the time, honestly, it's a lifesaver, particularly if you're getting old like me and you've not got a back for lifting patients constantly. Fluid balance is another thing that we want to keep an eye on, and assessing what that patient's individual fluid needs are. Patients, you know, may well be hypervolemic. We're going to see those perfusion parameters being affected that we just talked about. Hypervolemia we address as a priority. Patients will die because they become hypervolemic. They don't die quickly because they're dehydrated, and we look at a different type of parameters. So we look at hydration parameters when we're assessing hydration. So that's looking at, you know, how moist those patients' mucous membranes are, what's their skin tinting like, all those other things. So again, we're measuring different things in different ways for very different reasons in these patients. But we want to keep an eye, you know, on that fluid balance. Thinking about fluids we've got going in. You know, are they on a drip? How much drugs are they on? You know, every little bit counts. Are they eating at all? Are they drinking at all? So again, measuring those volumes to assess that accurately. We also want to think about fluids out, so measuring the volume of urine and feces if we can do, assessing the amount of vomit, and also for effusion, so if we've got dogs that have got abdominal drains in or big wound dressings, measuring the amount of fluid being produced in those as well, and calculating, are we keeping on top of those patients' fluids out and making sure we are doing so. Body temperature is another thing that we want to keep an eye on. You know, body temperature doesn't really allow us to completely exclude differentials, but it needs to be addressed. If patients have got prolonged abnormal temperatures, they're going to get organ dysfunction, they're at increased risk of morbidity, they're going to have a slow recovery. Patients that generally we have got a temperature above 40 degrees, we'd be concerned about, we would say those patients are pyrexic, and we don't generally go in and cool those patients. If patients have got temperatures above 42, that really can be quite dangerous. Again, most pyrexic patients tend to not get that hot, but you may get the occasional ones. But if they are patients that are hypothermic because they've got heat stroke, those are the ones that we want to cool down. So again, there's a reason for patients being pyrexic, and that's what we want to think of when we're looking at monitoring these patients, thinking about the whole of those patients and what's going on with them. If you get patients at the other end of the scale that are cold, be very careful. If you've got a hyperperfused, hypervolemic, hypothermic patient, be careful about warming up them up too quickly, because if you particularly put them on things like heat mats, you can make them vasodilate. If they're having they're struggling to perfuse their essential organs like their heart and their kidneys and their brain, you can just push them over the edge. So again, we want to think about warming those patients up slowly. And another thing that you can do, and we don't do this all the time, is if you want to assess perfusion, is look at core versus peripheral temperatures. So your peripheral temperature, so that's if you put a thermometer between toe webs, should not be no more than 4 or 5 degrees Celsius colder than that patient's core temperature. It's not something we do all the time. We can generally feel those patients and feel they are quite cold and know they're having issues perfusing that periphery. Other things that we're likely to do measure regularly in these patients is get some blood work from them and repeat blood samples just to see if things are working in the way that we expect them to work. And what we'll often do is what we call a 3-capillary tube minimum database. So this is getting a little bit of blood from a patient, measuring parameters that give us really useful information. And those parameters are normally going to be PCV, total solids, urea, glucose, and if you've got it available, lactate. So lactate is a byproduct of anaerobic respiration, so it's produced when we've got poor perfusion, we're not getting oxygen being delivered to tissues, and therefore those cells in those tissues are producing lactate as a byproduct. If you think about when you used to do PE at school, when I did PE, my thighs would burn because I was no Olympic athlete and I wasn't managing to get enough oxygen to my tissues, to my muscles that they needed, and they produce lactate as a byproduct. So we measure these parameters often regularly over a 24-hour period. As I said, it's cheap, it's easy to do, it's very low blood volume. If you wanted to, we can add other things in that are going to be relevant for that patient, particularly in our critically ill patients, we can add electrolytes in. When we're looking at PCV and total protein or total solids, we can do this very easily, very quickly. We can measure our total protein or our total solids on a refractometer. And we look at those two values and interpret them together. So where we've got a PCV and a total protein that are increased together, that generally suggests that patient is dehydrated. If they are both decreased together, that generally indicates a late bleed. It takes a while for those patients' values to kind of start to drop. And what you will actually get is something's decreasing earlier than one of those values decreasing earlier than the other. If we've got a PCV that's decreased but a normal total protein, that generally indicates that a patient is anemic. And as I said, if we get a bleed, what we'll normally find in an early bleed is that patient's PCV actually can go up a little bit. So what we get is splenic contraction and the release of red blood cells. But what will happen is their total protein will start to drop first. So that can sometimes give you an idea how long a patient's had a bleed for, be it an abdominal bleed, bleeding into the GI tract if they've got a ruptured ulcer or something like that. If you've got a normal PCV and a low total protein, that suggests that patient is losing protein somewhere. So a protein losing nephropathy or enteropathy or a big effusion or something like that. As I said, other parameters that we can look at are blood glucose, so looking whether that patient's hypo or hyperglycemic. Hypoglycemia commonly we can see with seizure in patients, with septic patients, patients with liver disease, with heat stroke, patients with insulinomas. We can sometimes see it in our geriatrics, we can see it in our pediatrics. On the other hand, hyperglycemia we'll see with diabetes, we can see it in stressed patients, particularly those stressed cats. We can also sometimes see it in really severe hypovolemia. As I said, other things that we can add on to that would be our electrolytes. We can measure lactate as well. And as I said, I will measure specific gravity and I'll do a dipstick on that urine if appropriate regularly to make sure that patient's able to concentrate their urine. But again, we'll take into consideration when we're looking at that specific gravity, how hydrated that patient is, what we think their renal function is like. Another really important part of patient monitoring is to make sure we're doing pain scoring. So this has changed a lot in the last few years. When I first started nursing, there wasn't an awful lot out there that looked at pain scoring. It wasn't, you know, a huge part of what we did as nursing. And we now have begun to realize that, you know, how vitally important assessing and addressing pain is in our patients. We've got different ways of pain scoring, and I would urge you to incorporate one of these and other techniques more than others into, you know, your patient assessment, your hospital charts. So we've got visual analog scales. So that is literally where we look at a patient and we scale them maybe on 0 to 3, 0 being a patient that's not painful at all, patients being a 3, ones that really are very impatient. We've got numerical weighting scales again, where we scale score a patient, and this is what they do a lot in humans, from 0 to 10. So we're 0 being non-painful, 10 being worst pain possible. We've got simple descriptive scales. We've got dynamic interactive visual analog scales. The one we're probably most familiar with and the one that's most commonly used and most useful are composite pain scales that are becoming increasingly common use now in veterinary practice. So the one we are probably most familiar with is a Glasgow composite pain scale that now is validated in cats as well. For a long time, it was only validated for use in dogs. So this was a scale that looked at pain levels for acute pain in dogs. And what this scale did was basically it combined observation, palpation of those patients, and patients' mobility as well. So this scoring system looked, and if you can see this, and I've got a small example of that scale on the right-hand side. This was basically where we look at that patient in their kennel. What are they doing? Do they seem quiet? Are they crying or whimpering? Are they growling? Are they snarling or screaming? What are they doing with the wound or the painful site? Are they ignoring it? Are they looking at it? Are they licking at it? Are they rubbing or chewing at it? If that patient can get up and move them about, we can take them out for a wee. If we put them on a lead, get them up. Are they moving around fine? Are they lame? Are they slow or reluctant to move? Do they seem very stiff? Will they not get up at all? We palpate that patient's surgical site or painful area if they've got one, and what do they do when we do that? Do they do nothing? Do they look around? Do they flinch? Do they growl? Do they snap? Do they cry? Overall, how happy does that patient seem, or do they feel very depressed? And do you feel that patient is comfortable? Is it unsettled? Is it restless? Is it hunched? Is it rigid? So we combine these numbers together with these scores. And at the point at which we need to either give that patient analgesia or give them a different dose or a different type or add in more analgesia is that our patient scores 6 or more out of 24 if we've been able to get them up and out on a lead, or 5 or more out of 20 if they are not able to get up and move around. So I've got a little video just to show you how we do this. This is a dog that had elbow dysplasia and has had arthroscopy. He's had a pre-med, which was methadone and ACP. He had some intraoperative analgesia, so he had some carprofen. He had some local anaesthetic into his joint and he was on fentanyl as well. And post-operatively, he's been on methadone for 12 hours and has been switched back to buprenorphine every 8 hours, with the last dose being given 4 hours previously. So this is a video of getting him up and around and palpating that elbow where he's had that surgery to see what he does. So just putting that lead on him, getting him up, getting him around. So looking at how easy it is for him to get up. He can get up, he's wagging his tail, but again, I would say we'd look at the breed with that. We know he's a Labrador, he wants to be happy, you know, he wants to please people. And then palpating that surgical site. Now, I would say he knows about that being done. But he's, you know, he doesn't seem overly unhappy about it. And, you know, a dog that's had arthroscopy, we don't want to expect him to be up and jumping around afterwards. You know, he's an older patient. Sorry, he's not too much of an older patient. But again, we can see he's a little bit lame. So, you know, we would go in, we would score that patient. And if I just click backwards and we have a look at that score for that patient, if we look at him, I think he was pretty quiet in his kennel, so I would give him a zero. He wasn't bothered about his painful area, so I would give him a zero again for that. When he gets up, he is a little bit lame, and we could either classify him as being lame or being slow. So either give him a one or two, and if you wanted to go on the side of caution, we could give him a two. When that palpation was done, I think we would say he looked around, so that would give him a one for that, and that maybe takes us up to a three. Overall, I don't think he seemed really happy and giddy and, you know, bouncing around. I think he was a little bit quiet, so I'd probably score him a one on that as well, so that's take us to a four. And overall, I would say he didn't seem really comfortable and laid back. I would say he maybe was slightly unsettled in that kennel. So that, again, I would give him a 1-4. Some of you may argue more. So for that, that would give us a 5 out of 24. So I don't think, I think for that we would continue what we were doing. We wouldn't need to necessarily add anything else in with that patient. Some of you may score him higher. And again, we're going to get a little bit of different interpretation depending on who does that scoring system. As I said, this scoring system was originally only available for pain scoring in dogs. It's now available in cats. And the analgesic intervention level in cats is a 4 out of 16. So we can see with the cat scale, we look at that cat in its cage. What's it doing? Is it quiet? Is it silent? Is it purring? Is it meowing? Is it crying, growling, or groaning? Question 2 is looking, does it seem relaxed? Is it licking its lips? Does it seem, is it cowering the back of its cage? Does it seem tense or hunched up? Does it seem rigid? What's it doing? What's it doing with its painful sight? Is it ignoring it or is it licking at it? We then are going to interact with that patient. What does it do? Does it respond when we stroke it? And how does it respond? Or is it, you know, happy, or does it seem unresponsive because it's really painful and not able to interact with you, or is it aggressive? We're going to palpate 5 centimeters around that surgical site. What does it do when you do that? Does it do nothing? Does it swish its tail? Does it cry? Does it growl? Does it bite? What's your general impression of that cat? Is it happy and content? Does it seem a little bit quiet or disinterested? Does it seem anxious or fearful? Does it seem dull? Does it seem depressed or grumpy? So we look at all those parameters on those patients and we can see them a little bit better in these photos, in these slides here. So another couple of videos. This is a video of Boris, who was a 4-year-old Siamese that's had an RTA, had a pelvic fracture, it's got tarsal luxation, a degloving injury. Surgery has not been performed yet, so this patient is still pre-surgery, receiving analgesia before he goes to surgery. He's been on buprenorphine that was given last 4 hours ago. So we're going to look at him, and I don't know if the audio is on this. If the audio isn't on this, just to let you know that you could hear this cat purring in the background. So we'll play this one. So I don't think you can hear it, but he was purring. So they're interacting with the cat at this point. He seems reasonably happy, but we'll see if we start to move down towards the back end of his body, which is the part that's really had issues. So we see how he is with that leg. Doesn't seem too bothered about that at this point in time, but then we see him doing that little paw to say, just please don't. Yeah, he's painful. He's not happy. If we get further down, he's a nice cat. That's what we've got to bear in mind. He's being as nice as he can and as polite as he can about saying, please don't do that. And he's now on the verge of, you know, he's certainly not being bitey, but he's on the verge of saying, this really is enough. And I think he does a little bit of a tail wag there, bit of swishing of that patient's tail at that point in time, which also tells us that cat was not happy with what we're doing. But again, you can see he's a nice cat. He's one of those cats that wants to interact with you. And I think that is something, sometimes one of the things where we need to have a little bit of experience of doing this and of understanding behavior in our patients and knowing what their personality is like. Sometimes we can have cats that are really aggressive and that's their normal behavior. That's where discussing it with owners is really important. So I know this is quite difficult to read because it's really, really small, and I'll just talk through what we decided in this patient. So question one was, what's he doing in his cage? Is he silent, purring, meowing, or crying and growling? He was purring, so we gave him a zero. He seemed quite relaxed, which is question number two. He wasn't licking his lips or seemed hunched or crouched, so we gave him a one for that because we gave him a zero for that because he seemed quite relaxed. We actually gave him a one for what was he doing around that painful area, because he didn't seem quite, you know, he was paying some attention to that painful, that, you know, that fractures, those wounds. Question four was, what did that patient do when we responded to stroking? And actually, he did respond well to just general stroking. He was quite happy for that to happen. Question five is, when we palpated that surgical site, what did he do? And that cat really noticeably actually wasn't happy. Yeah, I think he was beyond. He was a very nice cat, so we could see him swishing his tail, and actually, if the audio was on, you could see that he was a little bit unhappy about us doing that. So we scored him a two for that. And for overall, we felt that cat was quite dull and not happy and was still quite painful. So we gave him a 6 out of 16. And what we did in that situation is we actually gave him some more buprenorphine. And this is what happened when we rescored him again after some buprenorphine. So again, this is very much down to what the vets want to do. We could have actually said we're going to switch him to methadone. But if you look at this cat in this situation, you can see he then responded much more differently. Yeah. At this point, we had that leg going up. We had that foot going up to say, please keep out of the way. And there isn't that happening in that video. And by getting to this point, we then had that swishy tail. And this is not happening. So what we've done is we've just topped him up with a little bit more analgesia. Maybe, because that last dose was due 4 hours ago, maybe a little bit earlier than we would have originally thought to do. He seems quite relaxed about us really interacting with him. This cat's got a lot of painful fractures. Yeah, so at this point, what I'm seeing is a cat that's pretty happy, well analgesed. I think, again, knowing your species is important, because I think cats can respond differently to dogs with things like buprenorphine. I think we tend to go earlier for in cats, where we may, if this been a dog, gone for morphine. But that for me now is a cat that seems really quite happy. So I'm not going to talk through this next pain scoring one. You could do this, but for me, that cat would have come out with significantly lower scores at this point in time. Now, there are other pain scoring systems around which we don't generally use because they're not quite as easy to use, but I just want to mention them. There's another pain scale called the Bottu-Cartu pain scale that again involves looking at that cat's behavior. How does that cat seem? Do they seem happy, unhappy in their kennel? So picking up on body language, picking on what that patient does when we interact with their surgical wound, picking up what they do when we try to interact with them a whole. This also looks at what animals do when we feed them, you know, how do they seem overall in their kennel. So there's lots of other factors that we look at with this Bottu-Cartu pain scale in our patients. And it is, for me, a little bit more complicated. It looks at their posture, their activity, their attitude. You actually have to go in and measure blood pressure in these patients, which for me makes it quite difficult to do if you've got lots of patients. So it looks at what that blood pressure is like post-surgery compared to what it was like pre-surgery. And they've given that as a physiological variable. And as I said, along with is that cat eating more or not? And it just makes it quite complicated to do. I think the Glasgow is very simple to do. It's doing things that we're going to be doing with our patients all the time. So it doesn't add any more time onto what we'd already be doing with our cats in our clinic. So just to show you the difference that we can get in our patients, we're going to go back to Freddie. And we are going to see what happened in terms of his treatment. So what we actually did with treatment with him was we gave him some mannitol. So mannitol is an osmotic diuretic that pulls fluid from the extravascular space to the intravascular space. So it reduces swelling, because what it's doing is pulling fluid from tissues in the brain into the circulatory system. So it reduces swelling, and that's what had happened. Freddie's brain had swollen up, that because you can only fit so much blood into your brain, the blood flow was reduced, and those are the changes we saw in mentation. So, oops, wrong button. So if we look at Freddie now, you can see already, that was that dog that was sat on that table that was non-responsive to anything. This is a different dog altogether. Much brighter, much happier. If we look at his motor activity, this is a dog that was doing very odd things when we lifted limbs up and kind of looked at his proprioception. This is a dog that is not far off being completely back to normal now. So, almost, I would say, normally mobile. And that shows the difference that addressing perfusion and a lack of perfusion can make to your brain. So that's us done. What I would say overall, and that was a very quick whiz through within 1 hour, is, you know, think of putting all those parameters. Think of the whole with these patients. Think of everything that's going on with them. Think about the impact that, you know, changes in cardiovascular system, changes in perfusion, you know, all those things can impact on other areas within the body. We saw that there with Freddie. Reduced perfusion to the brain had that massive impact on that patient's central nervous system and what was going on with him. So think about everything. And as I said, we're the ones that are going to be, you know, with those patients, assessing how they do respond to, you know, treatment, assessing how they respond to fluids, and feeding that information back to those vets. So have confidence in what you're doing. If you've got concerns, go back to that person, feed back that information, say, you know, I'm not happy with this, you know, I would have expected this to happen, we've already done this and that's not happened. So, you know, that's part of our job. We are working together as one team, and that's what's hugely, hugely important. I don't know if anyone has any questions. If you do, feel free to send them through. There has been a couple that have just come through during the lecture, and mainly asking about Freddie as well. So someone's asking about why we saw such an impact in terms of that patient and Freddie's central nervous system and his mentation because of that blood flow. What happens if you have brain injury? And in Freddie's case, it was because he had reduced perfusion and his brain swelled up as because of that damage to his brain. The same things happen with a traumatic brain injury. So head injuries in cats or dogs where they've been hit by a car or kicked or dropped. What happens is your brain starts to swell up. There is only so much will fit within your skull. So if your brain starts to swell up, something else has got to give. And that's normally blood flow. Yeah. So what happens is we get reduced perfusion to the brain, and that's when we see those changes in mentation. So that's why the target, a lot of our treatment in those patients is aimed at restoring perfusion, getting blood flowing back to that patient's brain. And that's what we did with Freddie. We reduced some of that swelling so we could go get blood flowing normally back to his brain. We also would have had him on fluids as well. Somebody else is also asking about pain scoring and how often we do pain scoring in practice. I would say it very much depends on your patients. If I've got a patient and I'm worried that they seem, you know, they seem more painful than I expect them to do, I'll rescore them their pain score after an hour. We generally would do it every 4 hours in practice. We kind of expect to rescore them every 4 hours to make sure the analgesia that we're doing is appropriate. Again, as nurses, we can't decide that, but we can go back to the vets and say, I'm worried this patient's pretty painful, you know, can we look to either giving something sooner, you know, would you like to swap him over to something else? But again, we're the ones spending time with our patients, so we should really be the ones doing that pain scoring. I think we are ideally placed to be doing that within our patients. And our vets should have enough trust in us, had enough faith in us to take on board what we're saying. And again, make sure we're included as part of that team, as part of that whole patient care team as well. So that's hugely important. I hope that was useful. I know it was very quick. We could have probably easily made that into a 2-hour webinar, but I'm sure we'll get to cover lots of other things at Nurses Club at a later point in time. And thank you very much for listening, and I hope you all have a wonderful weekend.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Louise for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.